going on, we realize our consciousness is affected. There is this thing going on, what is called
the news, brought to you live.
All right. You are listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Jules Bigel, and this is the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. That's where I talk about some of the stories and share what I've been working on at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Today on the program, you're going to be hearing a lot of interviews as well as a coverage of a vigil last night. So that vigil was for the mosque attack that happened January 29th, 2017. I went up to Park X and spoke with community leaders, the planners of Muslim Awareness Week, which was started in Montreal in response to that horrific act of violence in Quebec City. And we honor as well the six men who were killed all those years ago, and the Islamophobia that is coming, ever growing these days as a result of the war in Gaza is discussed as well. Later on the program, I have an interview with the SMU VP External. That's McGill Student Society at the undergrad level. They're VP in charge of external affairs. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the student strike that's happening later this week at McGill, as well as Concordia University, and just how to oppose the out-of-province tuition hikes that are leaving many prospective students alarmed. Out-of-province tuition is set to go up by $3,000 for out-of-province students starting next fall. Now, later on the program, we've got some housing news covered. I'll be playing a story about an attempted eviction in Verdun. And we have an interview with housing lawyer Juliana DeHolke, where we talk about some of the common experiences that tenants in Montreal are going to be facing this time of year, as well as what everybody needs to know about their rights and how to exercise them. All right, and that is what we've got on the docket today for our show. Take a listen. Step outside of Park Metro in Montreal's Park Extension neighborhood, and you'll find pigeons nesting, men sitting at the tables that dot the square. On Monday, though, all eyes were on signs poking out of the snow. They showed the faces of six men who had their lives cut short 7 years before in an act of Islamophobic hate at a Quebec City mosque. Last night, Montrealers came to mourn them.
We are gathering here because right after the events on the 29th of January in 2017, the following day, there were thousands of Quebecers of all backgrounds who gathered in this place. So this is why we have this tradition that we have to meet here every year.
This is Sama Alabiari, a longtime host at CKUT, who was present at Monday's vigil. She's on the board of Muslim Awareness Week, which came about 6 years ago in response to the tragedy in Quebec City.
This was January 29, 2017, when the young Bissonnette stormed the Centre Culturel du Québec and killed six people. Ayman Derbali was left paralyzed for life, and there were 18 orphans left to mourn. After that, it was revealed that he acted because out of hate and fear, and he was influenced by extremist groups, basically getting his information from the internet. So in view of those tragic events, we thought, how can we live in peace? How can we live as Muslims without fearing that this would happen again to us, to our children? And we came with the idea of having a week to get to know us.
The idea is to bring non-Muslims with Muslims together to introduce a dialogue.
Speaking now is Salam El Moussaoui, co-founder of Muslim Awareness Week.
So that non-Muslims know Muslims close enough. It's not about the teachings of Islam per se, but it's about Muslims as human beings, regardless of their degree of following or practicing the religion itself.
This takes the form of art exhibitions, poetry readings, even a blood drive, saving lives to honor the men whose own lives were taken so brutally. Another event is a roundtable discussion on the conflict in Gaza. It's a topic that came up again and again in the speeches at Monday's vigil.
It even feels sadder than past years, because it doesn't matter really who is being slaughtered or killed or subjected to violence or injustice. As long as there are individuals or peoples who are subjected to such injustice without the world standing up for them, we are failing. We continue to be tribes and factions that only care about our own people. We are failing. We are failing badly. When we see that our politicians only pay lip service to the subject of justice and human rights and cut funding on humanitarian organizations that are the only refuge for millions of people, we are failing.
He's referring here to Canada's decision to pause funding for the UN agency responsible for almost all aid to Palestinians, after Israel alleged around a dozen of its 13,000 staff played a role in the October 7th Hamas attack. Here's El Moussaoui again.
It's unfortunate because sometimes we see some respectful organizations or governmental agencies taking, like having a blind eye on one side while noticing the other side. They are referencing to atrocities committed by one side and not the other, although they are very obvious. So these kinds of unjust positions fuel Islamophobia.
El Abiari says there are more ways the war in Gaza could lead to Islamophobia here in Montreal.
I think that the conflict in Gaza is going to exacerbate Islamophobia. And already we are seeing this happening in Europe and with the internet, you know. We shouldn't be surprised if we see the repercussions here.
And El Moussaoui says there are already laws in place that disproportionately harm Muslim Quebecers.
We in Canada live with we have the benefit that is not available in many parts of the world. It's a mosaic of different cultures, religions, and beliefs. But given laws such as Law 21, which prohibits hundreds of teachers from teaching, while we are in the midst of a shortage of teachers in Quebec, that doesn't help. That fuels Islamophobia.
I don't think that much has changed, but this is the greatest motivation for us to keep on going. Change doesn't come overnight. And when we do this kind of work, you don't expect to see immediate results. You do it because you have to do it. You're convinced that this is what is right. This is what should be done. And ultimately, sometimes surprisingly, results will be there.
I'm Jules Bigel, and you are back live in studio with the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. That was some coverage from last night's vigil honoring the six men who were killed at the mosque attack in Quebec City in 2017. Up next on the show, we have an interview with Liam Gaither. Liam is the VP External for the Student Society for Undergrads at McGill, and we're going to chat about the upcoming student strike happening this week across McGill and Concordia campus in protest of Quebec out-of-province tuition hikes. Here's our conversation. So thanks so much for chatting with me. Can I just get you to introduce yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Liam Gaither. I'm the VP External Affairs at the SSMU.
Today we're here to talk about the week of student strikes in protest of out-of-province tuition hikes being introduced by the Quebec government starting next fall. Can you just give me a little bit of background on what exactly has been proposed by the government and why it's such a big deal for students at McGill?
Yeah, so the government announced in October that they would be raising the price of tuition for out-of-province students to about 17 grand per semester. And after some developments, it's now lowered to $12,000 per semester. However, you know, students need to reject this overall. It's not an affordable tuition hike at all. And there is an aspect of this for international students as well, as they did announce that there would be a floor of $20,000, I believe, per year for international students.
So, you know, when you think about Quebec student fees, you think of tuition hikes, you think of 2012, right? The, the Maple Spring that happened. And, you know, the government wanted to raise tuition and students really mobilized against it across the province, Francophone and Anglophone students. But this latest move has just basically targeted a few Anglophone institutions. How, in your opinion, as VP External, as someone who's trying to organize people against this, how has that impacted the way in which folks in the province have responded to the tuition hikes?
Yeah, I mean, a sentence that's being used over and over is sort of that idea of divide and conquer, right? Like, they are trying to separate us from the rest of the Quebec population in order to increase tuition. And we know that at some point in the future, they're also going to want to increase to Quebec tuition, but maybe separate from out-of-province students. I really think that that's at the core of the issue of why, you know, mobilization is happening on these campuses and maybe not in other places, is because people don't see it within themselves that the tuition hike will affect them. But this affects our institutions, and this affects affordability for students overall, and so we need to care about this together.
Yeah, I mean, part of the rationale for the hikes was we're going to get more money from Anglophone out-of-province students, and then we're going to take that and put it back into the Francophone network. In your conversations, I guess, with folks at other universities, how are you seeing that side of it play out? Because I know some Francophone institutions have been vocally opposed, and then some have been supportive of the hikes.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I think most people I've spoken to are very opposed. They see it as sort of a BS idea to once again, like, divide us and sort of make the argument for funding Francophone universities without funding universities in general. But what most people want to fight for is free education, and that's what every campaign about tuition has been about since the 1960s in Quebec, actually, has always been to push for a public university system that is funded by the government, which is actually extremely achievable. So we just have to fight for it.
In terms of the fight itself, right, this week we have a student strike at McGill and Concordia. Can you tell me a little bit about what that will look like, what folks should expect to happen?
Yeah, so students are striking this Wednesday through Friday and picketing classes relevant to their departments or faculties. At Concordia, that looks like about 9,000 students that are on strike through various departments and faculty associations. And at McGill, it's been a little bit slower. We're at about 600 people. Students will be picketing those classes and are learning to picket maybe for the first time. The picketing can look different depending on what the association has chosen to go forward with. So it can sometimes be more of a hard picket where they're actually blocking the class in some way, or more of a soft picket where they just sort of announce that the strike is happening and encourage people to participate. But people won't be going to class and will have time to do other things, like engage in the number of workshops that are being offered over the next couple of days at Concordia and at McGill. So there's all sorts of workshops and film screenings, events to go to, because we're hoping to really build community out of these strikes and push for a larger mobilization overall.
Yeah, I have to ask, those numbers, there's a bit of a discrepancy there between what's happening at McGill and what's happening at Concordia. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, it really boils down to a couple factors, right? McGill has never been, like, the most mobilized or politicized campus in Quebec. And we tend to attract a slightly different crowd, maybe, than Concordia does. I think also that there are just so many more people involved directly in the mobilization there than there are at McGill. And those that have been pushing at McGill have done an excellent job of mobilizing departments involved. But at the end of the day, we just need more hands to be able to create a larger mobilization. And we're going to continue trying to push upwards in our trajectory. Just for context, right, like we've been organizing on this since it was announced in October. And there was a strike on November 30th. One-day strike that involved only 2,000 students at Concordia and none at McGill. And so really the numbers are up by a large amount since last time. And so we'll be setting higher and higher goals each time and hopefully build towards a general strike.
How would you, I guess, market this to students at McGill who maybe, you know, they won't personally be affected by the tuition hikes. They might be affected by austerity measures that the university puts in place as a result of financial pressures that they're under. But, you know, they're not going to be paying that extra $3K a year. Mm-hmm. And so just, you know, they don't see themselves as part of a political movement around this. What would you say to that to, you know, get them to strike and show them that they're is power, I guess, in this kind of mobilization?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's extremely hard to mobilize on something that seems, you know, altruistic almost, where you're sort of doing it for others or for the benefit of others. But that's kind of the point, is to be part of a collective mobilization for a better education system overall. And so opposing free tuition is one part of it. And yes, that's a personal part for students that aren't even in the province yet, haven't even come to the school where they would be paying that tuition. But we're not only fighting for that. We're fighting for free education. We're fighting for fair education, affordable education, and then on its way to free.
I think most students may not even know that this is going on. Mm-hmm. The question of whether or not to strike would never, in most cases, actually reach them, right? Mm-hmm. It's folks who've been voted into these kind of faculty or department positions who are getting that. So what is it going to take to get, from your perspective, more of these folks on board if you're looking for, I don't know, you're looking to foster a bigger mobilization at McGill?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, one expression we've been using again and again has been like that people are kind of clutching their pearls over it, over this issue, and that sort of when we ask these executives from department or faculty associations to at least consider the question of striking, they kind of, you know, they want to put us down very quickly. They don't really want to engage it too much because it's extremely disruptive and it would maybe put off their schooling for some time. But I think that overall people are not well informed on how striking works and why there's power in the strike and why we essentially only have power through our strike. Rather than any other kind of lobbying or legal action, this is where we have it. And so, what I think it would take to mobilize in the long run is, I mean, what we've been doing and what has been successful is to, and we would have to continue doing, is to like just ask people to put that question to their membership, rather than to just sort of kill it in that moment. And so, we say we're not asking you to, as an executive, to directly engage with a strike or directly to endorse it. You can be completely against it, but you should put the question to your membership. You should explain it well. And once that happens, then the people can decide if they're interested or not. But you have that power as an association to directly engage with your membership. You have people's attention, and so you should be asking these questions.
So you said that when students are taking time out of their classes to join the strike, they can also join a bunch of activities. And can you tell me more about what specifically you have planned this week?
Yeah, so there's a number of things going down at McGill and at Concordia, starting this tonight and going all the way until Friday. Most of them are workshops, talks with different people who have been involved in the student movement or adjacent movements in recent years. So maybe a couple examples, like there's a picketing workshop this evening to talk about how picketing works and really just simulate maybe some tense moments that you may experience if you are picketing. On Thursday, we have a film screening about the Parkdale rent strikes and how tenants were successfully able to organize their apartment buildings and organize a rent strike against sort of corporate landlords in Toronto. So talking more about the power of strikes. We have some other students that want to talk about anarchism in the student movement and what that can look like or what that has looked like in the past. And also some more people coming back from 2012 to talk about their experiences and maybe some Cole's notes for us in the near future as we move into a larger mobilization.
Yeah, and what do you have planned, I guess, going forward? I know maybe you can't share specifics, but it's end of January now. These tuition hikes come into effect September 2024. There's still quite a bit of time in between now and then. What are you looking to on the horizon, I guess, for the rest of the academic term while you're still VP External?
Yeah, absolutely. So my term will end in late May, right? So I'm trying to think about that a lot. But we're expecting the government to put the tuition hike officially through in their budget proposal in mid-March. That's kind of what we think is going to happen, as they would have done previously with other tuition hikes and as they usually do when they submit their budget. We're looking to try and oppose that strongly and build a broader student movement before that time. So that does shorten the timeline quite a bit, but the mobilization can still happen afterwards as we can continue to try and build negotiation power with the government and ask them, force them to pull back this measure. We're also looking to build, you know, a culture. The strike is really just sort of one part of this entire mobilization. Like, it also takes people being in the streets, takes people doing creative actions that just sort of raise awareness and create a sense of sort of things are happening, just giving people that impression. And, you know, we need to be in constant communication with the administration and all these different aspects. And so there are lots of ways to get involved in this mobilization. It just takes a lot more hands.
Yeah. And if folks are hearing about this and want to get involved, where can they go to learn more?
Yeah. So there are a lot of student association pages that are now posting pretty regularly about this if they want to just get some information. So at Concordia, there could be ASFA, the Arts and Sciences Federation Association, Federation of Associations. And at McGill, there's SMU_EA on Instagram. Or also Mugs, McGill Geography, has been posting quite a bit. So it would be at McGill Geography.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark your calendar every last Tuesday of the month and tune in to a special series of Soul Perspective on 90.3 FM.
Tuesday from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m.
Broadcasting live from West Haven Community Center in NDG.
Tune in to a special series of Soul Perspectives on 90.3 FM.
This Tuesday, January the 30th, we have special guests Zoo 365 Fitness, Sita Gabriel,
and DJ TJ.
Last but not least, West Haven Teens and the After School Program will be blessing us with a special segment.
So, don't forget, tune in every last Tuesday of the month.
Soul Perspective, live from West Haven Community Center. Tune in.
See you then.
This is a West Haven and CQT co-presentation.
You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bugel. It's every tenant's worst nightmare. You open up your letterbox or your inbox to find a notice that says you're being evicted. That's what happened to a group of Verdun tenants late last year.
Well, the notice told us that we needed to leave at the end of June, and it was an eviction notice. So it was pretty hard to take because it was just before, you know, New Year's Eve, and we thought it was pretty fishy, like the way it was written. And we right away we talked to each other and you know, decided that we needed to take action because it didn't feel right, you know.
This is Danny Bujold, one of the tenants of the fourplex on Boulevard La Salle, which we're not naming further due to privacy concerns. He says the notice was a shock, but also started ringing alarm bells. What was so strange was the reason given for the eviction. Here's Kay Lockyer from the Citizen Action Committee of Verdun, or CACV, which has been supporting the tenants in their appeal.
They received what is basically a standard notice of eviction, and what the box that was checked off on this notice was for change of use, in French, changement d'affectation. And the specific reason that was cited on this notice was that the landlord was going to be turning the units into social housing that was subsidized by the OMHM, our municipal housing office here in Montreal, under a program that doesn't have a name in English, the Programme Subvention Loyer. It's basically like subsidized housing, but semi-private, semi-public.
Despite being working parents, the tenants got together and got organized, contacting the CACV, the Quebec Housing Tribunal, and their member of National Assembly, Quebec Solidaire's Alejandra Zacamendes. She was able to confirm with the OMHM that there was no agreement for any kind of rent subsidy program for their building.
I was pissed. I mean, when I heard about the situation, the first thing that came to our mind was, is this true, right? We were really frustrated. Every eviction for us, it's a challenge. And then when we look at the information in the eviction notice, and then we went to the Office Municipal d'Habitation de Montréal, and they confirmed us that it's not true, that what it said in that notice is a lie, because there's no contract, there's no program with this contractor, there's nothing. And so that proved us that he's using an illegal notice.
The tenants say there were other red flags too, including the identity of the man who served them the notices, Alex Lepage. CQUT has attempted to reach Lepage for comment without any success.
Well, it's been difficult because the person in question just came at our apartment and told us he bought the place, and he was a new owner, but we didn't have any proof of that, and it's pretty complicated to check with Ville de Montréal and all that stuff to see if it's really true, and he told us stuff that didn't make any sense for us, so it's been a tough process.
One of the things that seemed strange was the choice to kick out tenants who were already struggling.
I think what really alerted them that something was off was that the landlord told them to sign up themselves for social housing, that they should get on the waiting list. And also these people, many of the tenants in the building qualify for social housing. They meet the criteria. So they just right off the bat said this doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that I would be evicted from my apartment for social housing when I myself could be a recipient of social housing. Why, you know, if you were turning this actually into a PSL, why wouldn't I have priority and right to occupancy?
We're all parents.
Yeah.
I just got my first child. She's 7 months old. Danny has two kids. Natasha has two kids as well. We cannot find another place for a family that would be affordable and that would fit us all.
Speaking now is Roxane de Bouctubal, another of the tenants on Boulevard La Salle.
The thing is, we're all in a very vulnerable situation financially. And when we received the notice, it said that they were going to put people in need instead of us that are already in a situation where we also are not fortunate enough to go live somewhere else. So that's kind of the irony. So that's why we're like, no, we have to fight this.
Yeah, it was pretty weird. And it was a changement d'affectation under the name of an organization that just produced affordable units. And it felt wrong because, Roxane said, the rent every single month is a good price for us. It's already affordable, and we're not going to be able to find another apartment in Verdun. The last few years, it went up so high in prices, so it's just it felt wrong, yeah.
In her follow-up on the case, Alejandra Sacaméndez learned this isn't the only time this type of fraudulent eviction has been tried. She says the way evictions are handled needs to change.
It's always on the tenant shoulders to prove the how it works. And for us, what's important is that we need to better define how we define evictions. And it has to be the Tribunal Administratif du Logement that allows for an eviction or not at the beginning, not after the emission notice is given.
The CACV, for their part, say in this hot housing market, fraudulent evictions are all too common. They want a moratorium on all permits that would lead to eviction until the housing crisis abates.
The way that we do evictions in this province is extremely flawed. A landlord can serve these eviction notices without having any kind of permits they don't have to have any proof that they have a deal to operate social housing, for example, and that this eviction is on legitimate grounds. They just have to serve these eviction notices. So if these tenants hadn't have been so proactive, and if they hadn't have informed themselves about their rights and gone to the proper resources, they could have easily have accepted the eviction, and I don't know where they would be. They could have signed, and they'd be in a very tricky spot.
Instead, after organizing and speaking to the media, these tenants will get to keep their apartments. in conversations with the tenants at RDI, Lepage said the notices were for a project that was never completed, and he won't be pursuing them further. Now, Denis and Roxane say they want others to learn from their example.
Well, I want people to know that they can take action and defend their rights, and it's worth it. It's not easy, it's difficult, and you know, but just don't leave your apartment without a fight, because it's really worth it. Even though you wait and you have a lot of phone calls to make and miss work, it's still gonna, you know, you're still gonna save money and be able to stay in your neighborhood and not have to move, fishy fashion, illegal fashion or something like that, you know?
Yeah. And if you feel that it's a lot to take upon yourself, you can reach out. Like I said, we reach out to our neighborhood committee, and that helped us a lot.
I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening. All right, we are back live in studio with the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. I'm your host, Jules, and you've just heard from some of the tenants who were caught up in an eviction scheme in Verdun. Before that was my interview with Liam Gaither, VP External of McGill's Undergrad Student Society. Up next on the program, I have an interview with Juliana Deholke, who's a Montreal housing lawyer who can talk you through some of the issues you may be facing as a tenant. Let's say you find yourself in a similar situation as the folks in Verdun we just heard from, or maybe you're worried about what the landlord is going to say in terms of rent increase. How do you respond to it? Well, we have all the answers for you, and then some. Take a listen. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bijal. 2024 has just begun, but it's already given a lot of Montreal tenants something to worry about. Quebec's Housing Tribunal just published rent increase guidelines with record highs. The RECLAC reports that forced evictions are on the rise, more than doubling from 2022 to 23. And the contentious Bill 31, which would effectively end the right to transfer your lease, is expected to pass in the coming weeks. Discussing all of that and more is Montreal housing lawyer Juliana Deholke. I had her on the show to go into the specifics on what exactly tenants need to know, whether they're receiving a notice from a landlord or trying to get a lease transfer in under the wire before Bill 31 passes. Here's our conversation.
So thanks so much for coming on the show, Juliana. Really appreciate it. Let's just kind of set the stage for listeners. I'd like this to be a kind of chat so that somebody at a very basic level who almost knows nothing can listen and hopefully take something from that. So just to start off, you know, we hear about these big actors in housing like the Régie du Logement, the Tribunal Administratif du Logement. What do they do?
Yeah. Actually, the TAL, the Tribunal Administratif de Logement, or TAL, is the new name for the Régie, but you will still get a lot of people calling it the Régie du Logement because for, you know, basically forever up until like, I don't know, a year and a half ago, it was the Régie du Logement. So even on some like government websites, you'll still see that it hasn't been changed, which I think adds to a lot of confusion for people. And some government workers still refer to it as the Régie. But it is now called the TAL, or the Tribunal Administratif de Logement. And that is where you are going to go if ever you're filing an application against your landlord, or if a landlord has filed an application against you. For example, if your rent is getting fixed, it is going to be at the TAL.
Thank you for bringing up fixing the rent, because we saw a few weeks ago the Housing Tribunal published their rent increase sort of estimates or guidelines. How do rent increases actually work in Quebec? You as a tenant might only see this in terms of a letter from your landlord, but what is the kind of policy that's put in place by the Housing Tribunal on that?
Yeah, so a lot of people get kind of fixated on this idea that their rent is allowed to go up by this certain percentage every year, and as if that's like one specific percentage that's the same for everybody. And that's not how it works. There is kind of a guideline where usually people's rent increases about the same amount, but it is not a fixed increase for everybody. How it works is there's actually a form that you can find online, but a very specific calculation that basically every landlord is supposed to make to decide how much the rent should increase. They often say, you know, you can do this yourself to check how much your rent should increase by, where unfortunately, it's kind of not that straightforward. Yes, you can access this form online. It's very easy to Google like TAL rent fixation form. It'll come up. It's difficult to fill it yourself because you usually need information like municipal taxes, property taxes, which I don't know about you, but personally, as a renter, I have no idea how much, you know, property tax my landlord is paying. So you usually don't have all the information to fill it out. Your landlord, however, does, and they're supposed to be filling that out to come up with the number. It's also going to take into account things like, you know, did they redo the roof last year? Did they have to redo your bathroom? Things like that are going to go into it, which is why it's not the same for everybody. And, you know, your friend might actually have a 5% rent increase and you only have a 3% increase, and both of those might be valid. So if you're not sure, or if they're sending you a rent increase that seems just like a random number, you know, do ask them to send out a completed version of that form.
You know, what I'm hearing, I guess, from the RECLAC, which is the a big umbrella organization for housing committees and renters groups in the province, is that what they see a lot of is that landlords will ask for an amount that is far above what you would get from doing that calculation, or far and above what the tribunal would put it in their estimates or their guidelines. This is not in every case. This is obviously the cases, the extreme cases that are coming across their desk. It seems like in those kind of cases, if a tenant would follow up and say, hey, can I see the calculation? The landlord might say no. If that happens, you know, what is the kind of recourse? What are the next steps that you would do as a renter if that was the response you received?
Absolutely. And some landlords definitely do make it difficult. And what is super important for everyone to remember is that it's always an option to just refuse the rent increase and you still can stay in your apartment. Sometimes they make it seem like you only have, you know, two options, either refuse it and move out or accept it and stay. But there is always that third option of refuse and stay. So if it really seems suspicious and they're refusing to kind of give you the justifications, then just straight up refuse the rent increase. And at that point, it actually becomes their obligation to file an application with the TAL if they want to increase the rent. So they have then 30 days to do that. If your landlord does do it, at that point, they will have to, you know, fill out the paperwork and fill out the forms. And if they don't do it, your rent will stay exactly the same as it is now.
Yeah. And can you tell me more about the fixation de loyer, the rent fixation process that happens when you get to the TAL? What exactly can a tenant expect to happen?
It really is just kind of a calculation at the end of the day. If you go to the TAL for a fixation de loyer, I think a lot of people get intimidated by it because it sounds like it's going to be a court hearing, but it's actually, you know, much more of a discussion because they really are just figuring out what number should be included in the calculation. It's not even an administrative judge most of the time. It's actually an administrative clerk. So this is really not, you know, you're not going to have to plead arguments even really, unless things kind of get a bit crazy. There obviously are exceptions, but for the most part, you're going to meet with the clerk. He's going to ask for the receipts from the landlord and he's going to go through them and then let you know what their rent increase is. And you might not have to say anything unless you're contesting certain receipts.
You know, it sounds as if it is a pretty straightforward process. And I know all the steps and guidelines are available on the TAL's website as well. But sometimes I think tenants have another fear, which is, okay, even if the TAL system is pretty straightforward, I can stay in my apartment, but maybe the fear comes from things that the landlord will say to try and discourage tenants from following that process. What kinds of things do you hear in general from the folks who come, you know, and seek legal advice in terms of their housing struggles?
Yeah, it's tough because it's one thing, you know, to have a legal right and recourse, and it's another thing to actually advocate for it and follow through. And the reality is, well, it is a fairly straightforward process in theory. You know, I have clients who live in the same building as their landlords. And, you know, if the relationship becomes very tense, that can be really hard. And obviously I understand why that discourages some people from going to the TAL. And I understand why, you know, it is best for some people not to go. I think for a lot of people, a rent increase ends up becoming this other bargaining chip. And, you know, if there's already repairs that haven't been done by the landlord, it just kind of adds on to this. And they start negotiating about kind of all these different moving parts when really they should have a right to a fair rent increase and have all the repairs done. And the landlord kind of makes them feel like they're just, you know, litigating unnecessarily.
Yeah. Another element of that is last year we saw a huge spike in evictions across the province, more than double what we saw in 2022. And what I've heard in some cases is a landlord going so far as to say, if you keep making trouble, basically, like, why would I want you as a tenant? Trying to use that as a punishment for speaking out. You know, what recourse or protections do tenants have if a landlord, you know, to get them out, will cook up some kind of story, like, I'm moving my mother into the unit, or I'm expanding the unit, knocking down the walls between two apartments, and they just have no way of knowing if that's true?
Yeah, I think it's often used as an intimidation tactic, this kind of either implicit or explicit attempt to get people out. And it's so important to remember that in Quebec, you know, you have this right to maintain your apartment. So, you know, if a landlord's threatening you with non-renewal of a lease, well, it's not really up to them. Your lease renews automatically. If you're paying your rent the first of the month, then really it can be quite hard to get you out, which is a good thing. That being said, there are things like repossession notices, which I've seen a ton of in the past month, and just getting a ton of calls of clients who have received repossession notices saying, you know, a family member is going to move in, or that there's going to be a subdivision or an enlargement of their property. And this is kind of the one way that landlords can try to get you out, even if you're paying your rent every month and there have been no other issues. That being said, I think a lot of people get these repossessions and think it's game over, that's kind of the trump card that landlords have, and that there's nothing we can do to fight back. But there's a lot of different ways that these repossession notices can be found to be invalid. And I would really encourage people to consult a lawyer or to try to, you know, find legal information elsewhere if they're served with one of these repossession notices, because all the time I have clients bring one to me and I have been able to prove in court that it was in bad faith, or, you know, wasn't sent in the correct timelines, or wasn't permitted by the law because, you know, they're saying they're going to subdivide something in a neighborhood that doesn't allow subdivisions. So just really make sure, you know, that you are looking into it if you get a repossession notice.
Yeah, you said that you had been receiving a lot of eviction notices. Is that kind of normal for this time of year? Or, you know, what are you seeing in the early days of 2024? And what kind of picture is that painting in terms of what you might expect for the rest of the year to come?
Yeah, well, January definitely is kind of always a busy time for repossessions because, you know, in Montreal, obviously so many people have a July 1st lease and there's that 6 month notice that people have to get. So had a lot of people served with notices, you know, in the past couple of months and court dates that are now coming up. So it's definitely repossession season. And, you know, I haven't been practicing that long, but my colleagues who have been practicing longer have said, you know, there's substantially more calls that we're getting about repossessions this year than other years. And it's honestly scary to see, especially, you know, I have a client, for example, who's a single mother who's being told that her place is going to be turned into a business because it's going to become an Airbnb. So she's getting kicked out of her place. And she lives pretty, you know, far north, not in a neighborhood that you would necessarily think of as a big Airbnb spot or particularly trendy. You know, she's a mother, and so that's her main concern. She's not trying to be in the kind of touristy hotspots, but just because she's kind of close to a metro, I guess her landlord thought, okay, I'm gonna change this into a business. I'm gonna make it an Airbnb. So it's kind of cases like that really scare me for the future of Montreal and the future of the tenants here.
Another big thing, obviously, on the horizon is Bill 31, this really contentious housing bill. And it looks like the National Assembly is very soon going to come back in session, and it could be passed as early as February. You know, how would that piece of legislation affect the kind of tenants who come and seek legal help? What would the impact of that be?
Yeah, I think there's a number of concerning things in Bill 31, and definitely the one at the front of my mind is the ability for landlords to refuse lease transfers and just end the lease. We've already seen such big rent hikes in Montreal because of things like Airbnbs and rent evictions and bad faith repossessions. And lease transfers have been one of the last ways that tenants have kind of tried to fight back and ensure that their rent is carried over to the next person. And, you know, while in theory, even without lease transfers, landlords are supposed to be held, you know, to the same rent increase notions, we know that the reality is that when one tenant leaves and a new one comes in that doesn't know the old tenant, you do just see massive, massive rent hikes. So I'm really concerned about that and the impact it'll have on my clients.
We might see Montrealers massively adopt the classic practice of hiding the previous lease before leaving an apartment. This is, I think, what is it? Tenants have, is it 10 days or 30 days after they move in to contest the rent or after they sign the lease, if they know what the previous rent is?
Yeah, you exactly. So you have 10 days after. So it's a really short timeline, which is another frustrating thing. But in that first 10 days after you sign a lease, you can apply to the TAL for them to fix the rent, which can be successful. I think a lot of people, I don't know, they're nervous to do it. They're nervous to sign a lease with a high rent and then apply for a fixation. I totally understand. But I have seen rents lowered from $1,500 down to $800 because of someone doing just that.
Yeah. I mean, it's that 10-day window that's really tricky, right? If you sign a lease 2 weeks in advance, then you move in, you find the old lease, there's nothing you can do at that point. But yeah, in addition to, you know, what's happening with Bill 31 and how obviously that's causing people a lot of grief, we still do have this window, right, where up until the bill becomes law, people will be able to start the lease transfer process. And if folks start it now, and let's say like in 2 weeks this law is passed, what would happen to that process? Would they be able to carry it through, or could their landlords just kind of wait until the bill becomes law and say, actually, no, you're out of luck?
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of questions on this, and it's a good question. And I do think we're kind of in a bit of a weird gray area, especially because depending on the laws, you know, sometimes when Parliament, the Quebec, you know, Assemblée Nationale passes something, they say, okay, this is going to be effective starting in 2 months from now, which, you know, I hope for Bill 31, because I think that would clear up some of the uncertainty around lease transfers. But it's just as possible that they, you know, pass the bill on a Monday and say it's effective starting the Tuesday. So that, you know, I think that would cause a lot of chaos. So I'm hoping that they're smart enough not to do that, but, you know, we will see. So I'm definitely encouraging people who are even, if they're thinking about lease transferring, now is a good time to do it, because now it is not law. We know we still have this right to lease transfer, and that is really clear. And I think as long as you know, there's a 15 days where a landlord has to respond to a lease transfer. Either they accept it, or if they don't respond, it's assumed rejected, or, you know, they might reject it, but they have to have valid reasons. So really, you know, I can't say for sure legally how it'll work with this new bill, but ideally you're going to get that, you know, lease transfer notice in at least 15 days before this bill becomes law. If it, you know, if you send in a lease transfer notice a couple of days before the bill becomes law, I really can't be sure what would happen, and it could legally get quite complicated.
Yeah, and I guess in the meantime, we'll have to wait and see. I know there is a big protest in Montreal that's planned on February 3rd, so this coming Saturday, by the RECLAC, and folks can, you know, find more info about that online, but has not yet been made into law. So there is still a little bit of time, a little bit of wiggle room before that happens. But yeah, I guess wrapping up, you know, we've talked a lot about some of the basic things that tenants need to know right now, need to hear. Obviously, there's a million different situations where you have a specific question and there's no readily available answer in these kind of guidelines. What is your advice to tenants who kind of are facing some kind of housing problem? They don't know where to turn. Like, where are some of the places up until the point of contacting a lawyer and mm-hmm. paying for legal help? Like, what are mm-hmm. some of the ways that folks can kind of take initiative and advocate for their rights here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our, you know, comités de logement, our local housing committees are something that are really underused or under... Just, I actually didn't know about them really when I was just a student in Montreal in, you know, my early 20s. I'm now very aware of them as a housing lawyer, but I wish kind of me and my friends had been more aware of them back at the time I was a student. So check out your local housing committees. They're great. They know a lot and they can really help you in the right direction for free and for just, you know, making the next decisions about even maybe whether you need to consult a lawyer or not. So definitely a great place to start. Educalois, the, you know, online website does have a lot of good legal information as well as the TAL's website. You can call the TAL, but that can be hard to get a hold of them, but you can give it a try. And I also think it's really valuable to speak to your friends, post on social media. I think that so many, you know, once you kind of start speaking out about these issues, everyone also always has someone who's been through it before. And I've often been linked into kind of chats on social media because someone sees someone's in need of help. But even my friends who aren't lawyers, you know, when you go through the process, it's usually something you remember. And I think it's so important to kind of build that solidarity among other tenants. So reach out to your friends, you know, be aware if you're talking to someone who's not a lawyer, take it with a grain of salt and maybe do your own research. But I still think that we can be such a valuable resource for each other as tenants.
Absolutely. And, you know, often when people are in larger buildings, you know, they have a landlord in common, maybe they're facing the same kind of eviction notice, rent increase, major work, no matter what it is. You can always also talk to your neighbors, because if they're going through the same thing, you know, you guys are always stronger together as well. But thank you so much for sharing your expertise. Yeah, always a little bit of a pleasure to have two jewels on the air. So I really appreciate you talking to me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime. I love talking about housing law.
Tu t'es occupé de ton ami qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière-en-santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
First, can I just get you to introduce yourself and your role?
Yeah. Okay, I'm Joanne Castonguay, and I'm a Health and Welfare Commissioner. So our mission is to evaluate the performance of the health and welfare system in Quebec and inform the population and the government on issues and to make recommendations in order to improve that performance.
Yes, and so you released the latest in a string of reports you've been doing on the home care system in Quebec. At a very basic level, I know this is complex stuff, but you know, what is home care and how does it work in Quebec? What's the ecosystem here?
Okay. Well, it's a very complex ecosystem because one of the findings that we had was just that it was never planned into a system, an ecosystem. So basically, the programs that were added over the years were to compensate for issues that were rising. So there was never any setback to look at it all and make sense of it so that it would be simplified and easier to navigate. So, but still, I can tell you that like there are three types of services that enters the home care denomination. And the first one would be nurse and professional services. nursing and professional services. The second one would be personal care, which would be all the personal hygiene issues. It could be the plaidie. I'm sorry, I don't know the name in English. And the final one would be domestic aid. So that would be more cleaning, doing grocery shopping, and maybe going through some bills and sorting, you know, things like that.
Yeah, so this latest report was the fourth in the series you've been putting out this year. And it had a sort of step back, you know, look at here are the main takeaways of what the problem areas are and what might need to change. In addition to just the complexity of the system, what are some of the big challenges facing home care in Quebec?
Well, the big challenge is basically we're not prepared for, we haven't put any money to provide for the loss of capacities that come with aging. And our approach right now is an approach that aims at compensating for the loss of capacities. And what we're saying is we should be going towards more an orientation that would aim at maintaining autonomy as opposed to compensating for the loss of capacity. So that would be one big issue. The next big issue would be that the system is not clear. Like, for instance, the policy that was developed in 2003 was never adopted by the government or the minister of the time. So it never received the attention or the approval that it needed in order to make these services universal. And so they are believed to be universal, but they don't have the means or they're not organized to be universal. And because it's not clear if it's universal and or not, then the decisions come to the ones that are providing the service. And because they don't have enough resources to do it, then they'll just decide the best they can with the resources they have at the time. So, it needs to be better organized and we need to do more prevention. We need to make it a simpler system, to have the rules that are clear and also make the difference. You know, one of the suggestions that we made is that they should make the rules for funding clear, but they should also have many strategies in order to make sure that the services can be funded on the long term. Because when we looked at the forecast, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to, it's going to be a very big challenge to pay.
Yeah, that is one thing that comes up, right, is that the costs of home care are, these preventative costs are less than medicalizing people, institutionalizing them, having, you know, doctors treat things that come up because they don't receive the care. But you're saying that even with that, maybe because of the big aging population we have, it's still going to be a big strain on the provincial budget, that things will have to be making trade-offs, basically.
Yeah, what we're saying is we have to make trade-offs, and we're saying that there are better ways to do it. We could get a lot of efficiency into the system, and we would even respond better to what the population wants, because the population doesn't want to be institutionalized. That, you know, when we ask them what were their preferences, their preferences go towards being at home as long as possible. But those preferences will change when there are a total loss of capacity, basically, like when it's really severe.
I know another big issue that people talk about is just, you know, when you're accessing services initially, obviously it's very complex, but then let's say you do have a home care agency that's set up to provide you care. You might not know who's coming day to day or week to week. There seems to be, from what I've heard at least, a lack of sort of oversight, both on the labor side of the folks working in the system and then the actual care provision day to day. What about that whole part of the equation needs to change as well?
To respond to that kind of issues, we're basically saying that the organization of services should be decentralized. It should be contracted in bundles so that each location would be able to provide the services with the resources that they have locally. The other thing that we said is that there's a lot of projects right now that are being financed through innovation and research funds. And those projects, you know, will provide, you know, fantastic solutions in order to be more humane and bring people together that are around, that live around the people, either to you know, say hello once, you know, on a regular basis, making sure, checking if they're okay, doing errands once in a while. There are all sorts of things that are showing that that brings a lot of benefits to the elderly and helps them maintain their autonomy. And these projects should be encouraged. Right now, they're financed through the research funds. And once they're over, although they show that they brought benefits, they can't find the funds to remain in function. So we should not.
www.cKUT.ca on the World Wide Web. News,
interviews, and music. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM, broadcasting live. My name is Candace, and I'm your host for today's show. Today's episode focuses entirely on a panel discussion on Guantanamo prison.